Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Hey, this is Jack Inslee, executive producer at heritageradionetwork.org. We sincerely apologize for the audio quality of this week's episode of Word of Mouth. We experienced technical difficulties through the recording. Fortunately, we were able to get a backup recording, though the quality is not ideal or close to our standards. We hope you do enjoy this recording. First off, on Word of Mouth, we're joined by chef owner Max Sussman of the Cleveland for his attack of the green market. And then in a few minutes, we welcome here in studio with Leyte, chef partner of Maialino, Nick Anderer, who's just birthed his second Union Square Hospitality Group baby, the brand spanking new Marta Restaurant in the Martha Washington Hotel. The Indiana native and Columbia University art history major and finance minor talks design, surfing, oven splurging, and he'll share stories of working with the legendary Danny Meyer. Stay to the end as Leyte winds it down with Nick, who has brought us his favorite wine pairing with pizza. And here is the Green Market clip.
I'm at the Union Square Green Market with Max Sussman, chef and partner at the Cleveland in Soho.
Hello.
Hey.
Thanks. How's it going?
Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah.
It's very...
strangely humid and hot.
It feels just like California, where I just came from.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're lucky bears right now.
I feel like we've had an LA weather fall in New York. It's been like sunny and nice the whole time.
It's our compensation for suffering the last winter.
Yeah.
So tell me, how do you usually attack the green market?
I feel like it's a little different every time, because it's like, really depends where you start, right? So you could start at any corner and then just walk through, but usually what I do is I do a walkthrough and then I plan my return.
Okay.
So I do like a recon.
Yeah.
And then I go back and I do all the actual purchasing. And then you have to strategize about where to put the stuff, because you end up with, like, you know, 50 to 100 pounds of produce, and we're not Gramercy Tavern, so we don't have, like, you know, a Rubbermaid cart that we can stack everything up on.
Right.
It's just brute force. So, yeah, so usually it's the recon, the purchasing, and then you start to, like, try to be like, all right, where can I start stacking my stuff?
Yeah.
And there's a great stand that over there that is usually really nice about it,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to blow up their spot, but they're really friendly. So
yeah, to you, though.
Yeah.
Every guy's got their guy.
Yeah, we're just like, hey, you mind if I leave this here for a little while? And they're like, oh, as long as you come back, because a lot of people just forget, and then they leave all their stuff. But yeah, usually it's, you know, everyone's got their favorite stands and their favorite products,
mm-hmm.
and some things they really like buying at the market, some things that they don't really feel is, like, worth it or necessary. So the best part is that, like, it's shopping with the seasons. Everything's different, even from week to week.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, different things. Different things look good, and it really keeps you on your toes, because if you really want to do a market-driven menu, you might have something one week that looks great, and then it might be completely gone the next week, and
mm-hmm.
then back the week after that. So it's challenging.
Well,
but it makes it more
challenges
fun.
And creativity.
Yeah.
So what are you excited about today?
All right, well, today I noticed these beautiful chrysanthemum greens. They are really peppery and have an interesting spice to them, which
mm-hmm.
is, and they have a really herbaceous quality. So they're kind of like a cross between mustard greens and parsley or something like that. And they're hardy enough that you can saute them, but the little guys, you can eat them raw. And these just look really beautiful to me. They're small. Sometimes they grow really big and get tough, woody, and fibrous, and this flavor is, like, actually a little too strong. But when they're young and tender, it's a little fresher, and you can eat them raw. Just put the little leaves on this garnish. So we have this new dish that just went on the menu last night, but I thought it needed another little thing.
Mm-hmm. And what is that dish?
It's a cured and grilled mackerel.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's served with a smoked mussel aioli and some rye breadcrumbs. So we smoke the mussels and use them as a base to build the aioli instead of egg yolks. And we are having our baker make some delicious caraway rye, which I then make into breadcrumbs, much to his dismay. I don't know if he loves the fact that his bread's turning into breadcrumbs. It's really good. But for just like a little bit of like peppery freshness, I think these chrysanthemum greens are going to be like just what it needs.
And do you know this seasonality of these chrysanthemum greens, also called shungiku?
Shungiku. I know that they are around from like the middle part of the summer into the fall. So I think it's definitely one of those things that grows in the hot to cool, like later part of the summer. Mm-hmm.
But not so much into deeper winter time.
Yeah, they're a little delicate, I think, for that.
Oh, interesting. They look tougher, but...
But you can feel the leaves are actually kind of soft.
Right.
Like a herb.
Yeah, they're...
You should try one. It's kind
they
of
are? Mm.
It's really unusual.
Oh, wow.
It doesn't really taste like... It's hard to really compare it because it's such an unusual flavor compared to anything else.
It gets, like, up in your nose.
Yeah. And aromatic,
And I would totally, like... This, you know, this is the stuff that... This is one of those esoteric Chinese vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, in my life as a little kid eating hot pot, in addition to the Napa cabbage,
so just throwing a bunch of
that, and it just kind of, you know, at that point it becomes the end of the hot pot where you want something funkier in there, or something more herbaceous, and it just changes the whole broth.
That's awesome.
So wow, this is really interesting. This is my first time revisiting.
That's so cool.
Like I know this
yeah,
vegetable.
Yeah, you know the flavor. It's familiar.
First time you had chrysanthemum greens, the first time you met them, you didn't really like them, right?
I mean, I think, yeah, it's definitely something it took me a little while to warm up to. I had them in the salad, and they were a little bit overgrown and really big, and after like three bites, I was like, I don't really want to be eating this anymore.
You smashed your face into a weed patch.
Yeah, I would like to stop eating this green. But now that I've, like, used them a little differently... Pick the little tender guys out. I enjoy it a lot more.
So at home, then you could throw it in any soups. You know, at the very end of it.
Oh, for sure, it's a great soup green, as you know, obviously better than I. But you could also just do like a really quick sauté if you're making something that itself has some body to it. Say you're like roasting eggplant or sautéing potatoes or onions or anything like that, and you just kind of throw this in almost like an herb, like
right.
a garnish, like you're wilting down.
It's somewhere between a hearty green and an herb.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much, Max, for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Max Sussman of the Cleveland in Soho, and you're going to love his food if you love the non-pizza dishes, in particular at Roberto's Pizza, where he was last at, which is actually right where we hide this little nonprofit radio station. So welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. If you relish what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Leyte Su, LEITIHSU, at Heritage_radio, #WOMShow. That's short for Word of Mouth Show. And with that, I'm so pleased to welcome people we like. Chef owner Nick Ander of the brand spanking new Roman Pizzeria by Union Square Hospitality Group called Marta.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
You must be very busy.
Very.
Baby is an infant at 7 weeks old.
I think this is the very first time I snuck away from a lunch service. I've been there every single service.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
what an honor. And I just got in from Milano yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You were there for how long?
A couple days, and I was all around Italy.
That's not enough time.
I know. Well, I learned that you have quite the love affair with Italy, in particular Rome. But first, let's stay local, and congrats on the opening.
Thank you.
The food is delicious. Your cooking is very clean. And... you know, everyone talks about the pizza, but I think what's really rad about Marta is the fact that you get to cook on a wood-burning grill.
Yeah, It was part of the plan all along. If we were going to go through all the time and, quite frankly, money it takes to get wood burning to happen in Manhattan in the middle of all these big buildings and venting up to the 14th story, we said, well, why not throw in the raddest grill that we could possibly think of and just cook everything over fire? Chefs love that shit. They love, you know, cooking over open flame and, you know, barbecuing. And so it's kind of fun to be able to bring what we do, like, on weekends into the restaurant on a daily basis.
Well, we love it, too, because it makes the fish and the meat taste extra, like, caramel and, like, barbecuing outside, and we can really only do that outside.
Yeah, it does all the hard work for us. It makes us look good.
Right. Except that it must take some skill to manage the fire.
Yeah, I mean, we throw in all sorts of little gadgets in this grill that we built. I mean, I got to give props to Ben Eisendraft from Grillworks for designing this thing with me. I mean, he took on quite a project here. And there's so many things that are built in that try to eliminate variables that happen with fire. I mean, maintaining heat, obviously, being the primary one, and, you know, burning wood, you know, flames shoot up. They, you know, have hot spots. It's very unpredictable. So, you know, we have, you know, had, I mean, he really designed this amazing thing where you can, you know, lower and raise the grate to control temperature, but also, like, the way that he's built these awesome fire cages. You constantly have fire burning towards the back of the grill. And then you never actually cook over the flame. You're always sweeping the embers that are being produced by that fire cage underneath. And that's a pretty cool construction. And then we also have this weird little smoke, not little, it's pretty big, smoke box that sits in between these two fire cages that has two different levels. And that's the thing we spend a lot of time trying to design and figure out a way that you can roast, you know, not necessarily at super high temperatures, that you can actually put, you know, things that require a little more delicate, you know, heat, like chicken, and roast them inside there, and also some slow smoke if you want to do, like, short ribs or something like that. So yeah, it's a fun piece of equipment.
So it must have been so fun to go shopping for the new baby. Like, for folks who are not in the know about all the latest in wood burning ovens and grills, what is this like? Is this like the Rolls Royce of that world, or?
It's more like we had a chop shop that we were able to put together, like our dream car or something.
Oh,
it's,
really?
It's not, yeah, it's like, because it's completely customized. It's like there's nothing on there that is something that, I mean, I don't want to say it wasn't inspired by other things that I've seen, but it's completely original. It's like we had these ideas for how we wanted to set up the station. We wanted, like, two cooks and this little fire pit who could, you know, basically do a versatile style of cooking where you can sear on a plancha, you can grill over open flame, you could slow smoke, and do it all in one tight little sort of, like, 8-foot corner of this kitchen. And yeah, so everything was just so completely customized. The first time I've ever had the opportunity to do something. It's mostly in New York City, people open restaurants, they inherit a bunch of stuff, and they try to figure out how to repurpose it, which is great, you know. And that's the way, it's almost easier that way than it is to try to create from scratch. Like, I was given this vanilla box, and it's like, you know, go design, do it. And I'm like, well, if anything is wrong, it's my fault because I drew it in there. And so it's a little nerve-wracking, like, seeing the space come together, and you're like, wow, this actually works. It's
decision-making as an obsessive artist. Like, it's really excruciating. Well, for some vegetarians and pescatarians, I just have to, I don't usually even talk about food on the show. It's funny, it's a food radio show, but I'm way more interested in, like, you as a human being. But I have to shout out the Frito Misto. Just, like, breaded so delicately and skate. And little tiny fishies.
it's the Japanese upbringing.
Yep, exactly.
The tempura.
Yes.
That's what it's, yeah, it's just basically a fancy tempura batter.
It's really mighty fine. Which, by the way, speaking of, so, yes, your background is slightly Japanese?
My mom is Japanese-American from Chicago, born and raised in Chicago. My dad is German-American, born and raised in Philadelphia. And then I was, like, as you said earlier, born in South Bend, Indiana, but moved to New York when I was 2. So I like to think I'm a New Yorker, although the true blood's here. But, like, now you're not New Yorker.
Oh.
Unless you're born here. But I've been here for 33 years now. So
you also, like, look so cool whenever I see you outside of the kitchen. It's like you've got like the leather jacket like thing going on. I'm just trying to paint for people a picture of what.
Everybody dresses like they're in a band nowadays, right?
So what?
Just
what,
trying to fit in.
What is the? Yeah, exactly. I know. Seriously, I was once on a fashion shoot, and every single person was in a leather jacket, and then I happened to be. So I was like, phew, like, thank goodness I
busted out my wool jacket today, which was a mistake.
It's
like 70 degrees outside.
You have to stay close to your mobile weather forecaster.
I know. I just rolled out of bed and came straight here.
What is your tattoo? It's really pretty.
This is a tattoo of a place in Hawaii, Waimea Valley. I go there. I'd like to go there about once a year. I've skipped a couple of years trying to open up this beast of a restaurant. But I just gave it to a tattoo artist that a friend of mine knows and had him just sort of interpret a couple pictures of this beautiful Waimea Valley rainforest place that was like kind of like my getaway sanctuary.
Nice job. There are the good tattoos in the world and there are the bad tattoos. So back to the menu. Is the eggplant still on the menu?
No more!
Oh my gosh.
If you could find some for me, I'll cook it for you.
What kind of eggplant is that?
It was a Rosa Bianca eggplant. They're like these purple and white streaked southern Italian eggplants. It's, in my opinion, the only one you can use for eggplant parmesan. Except no substitutes.
That's very intense of you. But it is the best eggplant parmesan I've ever had.
Oh, thank you.
So let's talk Italy. In many ways, Maialino and Marta are this like manifestation of your obsession with Roma.
Yeah. I mean, it started, I guess, in college. I mean, I was studying art history. Loved Italian art, architecture, urban planning, loved Rome in particular, and studying the Barminis and Berninis of the world, and did this crazy stuff that spans from sculpture to painting to architecture to urban planning. And so I had an itch to go out to Rome to study in it, so I did that my junior year, and just fell in love with the city of Rome. That's where I was I was supposed to be for only one semester, and then I signed up for a second semester because I just didn't feel like I got enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that second semester, I moved out of this living situation where I was with a bunch of American students and into a situation where I was like living with real people and was forced to speak Italian and forced to like cook for myself. And I think that's where I started to be like, oh, wow, there's like a food culture that is much more alive out here. And you couldn't really put your finger on it back then, like as a student. But I think now I can sort of visualize it better, like what it was I was experiencing. It was like, the whole idea that everybody out there really cares about their particular region. They're really proud of what's going on, whether it's soccer or food or a wine or the local barber shop or whatever it is. It's like everything is so localized. They don't have to really preach or talk about local. It's just the way things are.
Vehemently and, local.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I appreciate that so much more now because, people talk about that all the time in restaurants. And it's like, oh, are you supporting your local suppliers? Like that should just be a given. It's like, I'm sick and tired of talking about it. It's like, that's just what we all do and we should do.
Right. And foodie, the word is not really a thing. Like,
yeah. It's like, cause you couldn't explain to an Italian what that is. It doesn't make any sense. It's like, that's everybody. Somebody who loves food and drink and thinks about it all the time. It's like, everybody does that. It's just,
I ran into someone named Ottavia in Italy, and even though she is allergic to tomatoes as an Italian, she was
able... The only worst thing would be gluten, I guess.
Yeah, and she also agreed with that. She was still able to explain, the different kinds of braseola, and she was still able to be conversant, even though she has a very small stomach and is a very tiny person. So then you studied abroad in Rome and then you returned later on in life.
So I was there my junior year of college. When I got back from Rome, I decided, as I was finishing up my senior year of college to start cooking immediately because I just wanted to see if it was something that would stick. and that it wasn't just like a hobby.
So first, wait, what did you, you studied art history major and finance minor?
Yeah, I had a concentration in finance, and I was sort of like the safety net in case, well, not in case, it's like I knew that I wasn't going to have a profession in art history. I wasn't going to teach, I guess, those were the options.
So, but
teach
went,
or teach.
you went to Columbia University, uh-huh. and you did a finance internship.
Yeah, I was working on the mercantile exchanges, assistance to some guys that were trading commodities on the, heating oil and natural gas. And for me, it was just thankless work, grunt work, and completely stressful, but no reward, nothing to look at, like what the hell did I create?
Well, so you can either do grunt work for a lot of dollars or grunt work in the kitchen for not a lot of dollars.
I chose to be poor.
Yes. So how,
to be poor, yeah.
How did you have that clarity as a young guy?
Well, when you're young, it's like, it's so easy. You can do whatever the hell you want, right? It's like, I didn't have a plan. I just said, I'm going to start cooking at, I went to the water club because I had a friend who hung out at one of the local dives by Columbia who was a line cook. And I was always fascinated, like, oh man, cooking is such like a sexy profession. It's like right like that for Kitchen Confidential to come out. I just read that book and I was like, yeah, I'm going to go check out this cooking thing. So he got me in the door at the water club. I had no experience, just begged the chef to give me a job, and he did. And it just stuck. I just loved being in the kitchen, loved, trying to learn something new every day. I was probably one of those annoying cooks that asked too many questions like off the bat. And then I realized, oh, I got to work. I got to put my head down. That's how I'm going to get ahead. So I learned that lesson real quickly. I just went from one job to the next, and what started, I guess, as a hobby in Rome just turned into something that was like, this is what I was meant to do. I need to be in a kitchen. Like whenever I was out of a kitchen, I felt kind of like I need to get back in one.
That's awesome, because yeah. I also started out my career in finance. I was at Merrill Lynch in investment banking.
Yeah, that sounds horrible.
And I having Asian woman guilt and sort of the thing where I was like, goody two shoes, I hope not annoying, good, really good grades. I thought investment banking is the thing I have to go to have all the doors open to me. Of course, the what's behind that door is not this incredible life of being around deliciousness and mm-hmm. beauty. So congrats to you on your life quick-wittedness.
Same to you. Congrats on figuring that out. Right?
Oh, it's really a privilege. Okay, so then you started cooking,
mm-hmm.
and then did your parents like mind that
My parents, I mean, they're both teachers, and they're both, they're supporters of creative arts, and they saw that there was no way I was going to get any love out of working on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of, oddly enough, relieved to hear that I was like, I'm going to leave Wall Street and start cooking. Whereas I think a lot of more traditional, especially in the Asian world, Asian parents are like, oh, man, get that paycheck, come on. they definitely supported the fact that I was, giving that up for good reason.
And your mom was a huge influence on the food front when you were a kid.
She definitely was. I mean, I cooked a lot with my mom at home. That's kind of where, it all kind of starts, I think. And I had the crazy good fortune of being in a family that we had dinner together every single night.
Wow.
Wow. And she would make something different almost all the time. So she would always be like, trying to figure out new stuff to do. And just to cook. We always liked Italian food.
Really?
I don't know why. It was never something that, was, my mom's, like I said, Japanese American, German American. I don't know where the Italian came from, but we all loved it.
And New York family.
I mean, I guess what's not to like? Italian food never goes out of style, right? So she experimented a lot with that stuff, and then so did I. It's kind of like coming full circle. It's like I always had an itch to do something Italian, no matter where I was working. I mean, I worked, fancy tavern, tabla. I was always trying to find ways to get back to Italian food. So,
what are some dishes that you and your mom would create together?
Oh man, I loved sausage. I remember doing lots of things with sausage. Like I felt like sausage was like the foolproof food. You could make everything taste good. Like that and bacon, Very immature cook. I just like to put sausage in it. It's going to taste good. It's going to be fine. And I just remember making all sorts of pasta sauces with sausage and, different kinds of broccoli and cauliflower mixed with sausage. And You know, it's I mean, it's all a haze right now. I probably made a bunch of really horrible food too. Yeah, my mom is an excellent cook. A lot of people I know have opposite stories of like, oh, their mom was a horrible cook, and that's why they had to learn how to cook so they could eat something good. But that was not the case in my family.
What do you cook for your mom and dad when they come into Marta and Milino?
I just, you know, I want them to see the menu. I want to see the real thing.
So it's you like just I'm blow not, them up.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think a lot of times chefs have a tendency to like, you know, try to go over the top sometimes when the friends and family come in.
Yeah.
I'm going to go off the menu and do these crazy tasting. And it's like, I put these things on the menu because I really like them. So if somebody comes in, they should better enjoy the stuff that I'm serving everybody else today. So I don't try to go crazy and do off menu stuff, you know.
Moms always seem to have strong opinions. Has she provided any of her opinions about the new baby?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, they'll tell me if something's good, they'll tell me if something's bad. I mean, of course, you know, they came in the first time, and yeah, my dad, too, he's very opinionated about food. He'll let me know right away if something didn't have enough salt or this didn't have enough punch. Like, he's always, like, telling me, oh, you know, you cook so aggressively. And also, like, if something falls flat, he's the first person to let me know. It's like, come on, that's not you.
So I want to share some social media info here. At Marta Manhattan, connect with the team. At Union Square Hospital, at USHGNYC, and at Nick Anderer, that's NICKANDERER. Stay close, because after this very quick commercial break, we'll talk about why art history has a lot to do with menu creation, and tell some stories about Johnny Meyer.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. And today, live in the studio with me, we have chef partner Nick Ander of Milino, and also the brand new Marta, a Roman pizzeria by the Unisco Hospitality Group, folks. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey.
So, how did this, the hotel and the restaurant are beautiful, Martha Washington Hotel. How did the hotel come to be, the name and everything?
So it's kind of an interesting building. It used to be the Martha Washington Hotel. They're bringing back that old name. It had passed through several hands over the past few decades, but back like in the 30s and 40s, it was the first woman's only hotel in New York City. It's also, if you go back and if you watch the Valley of the Dolls, the opening scene where Veronica Lake comes to New York City, like, she walks straight into the Martha Washington Hotel, and you can see the big neon sign outside. So I think everybody was kind of, you know, interested in getting back to the roots of the building. Quite frankly, when I first saw the space, I thought on the inside, I just thought it was so ugly, and I was like, what are we getting ourselves into here? But thankfully, Ed Sheets, who now owns the hotel, who we partnered with, had this great vision along with us to you know, bring on Annabelle Seldorf, who's an amazing designer, architect, to just sort of reinvent the whole interior space. And they even got permission from Landmarks to change a little bit of the facade so that we have these awesome floor-to-ceiling windows now. So if you walk by on 29th Street, you can actually see straight in. You see this monster behemoth pizza oven sitting at the back of the restaurant. But yeah, she was really smart about the way she went about, you know, things that I didn't necessarily think would have worked out, really did work out, like the whole openness of the restaurant, how it remains open to the hotel lobby and to the entrance, and it's just sort of, there's nothing to shield it from its surroundings. So that it's a tough concept for a restaurateur or a chef to wrap his brain around, because you want to always have control over your four walls and
right.
What's happening within them. But this is like Yes, it was just wide open.
I noticed that you don't know where the restaurant ends and begins. Kind of like overflows, the air like overflows into the lobby overflows into the restaurant. It's
good. It's like the energy from the restaurant sort of like just trickles into the rest of the hotel.
And it's really fresh.
That's kind of fun.
And everything about the design is so thoughtful. I think my first thought, actually, I look up and the ceilings are so high and the light fixtures could have very well been like weird ones. And you're like, why are they so weird? but they're unique and beautiful and elegant, even though they are.
Yeah,
on the weirder
lights,
side.
Lights are cool. By Apparatus did those lights, and they it almost looks like they're like big sticks, like fire logs. And I thought that was kind of cool.
They're arty, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like you said, the ceiling's about 20 feet high, and that was one of my biggest concerns is how to like turn this like really vacuous space into something that's cozy. It's like you do in a pizzeria, you can't forget that like. Pizza is supposed to be comfort food.
Right.
You want to make people feel at home. So the fire does a lot for that. Like the fact that we have this open kitchen with these two wood burning ovens that are constantly going, and then the wood burning grill right next to it. So the flame definitely helps. And then making that sort of kitchen the focal point of the whole restaurant, I think, is a cool idea. I've never worked in an open kitchen before, and I never had a desire to, but I knew that this space kind of was begging for it.
Mm-hmm.
You really needed to have that energy flow out into the dining room. And then, like you said, the light fixtures that are, you know, drop down about 10 feet just sort of, you know, make the space feel a little bit more intimate. And then we also have that mezzanine that shoots off the one side of the room, which creates little alcoves on one side of the restaurant. So it kind of feels like they have
cozy spots.
Yeah.
So Marcia, the name, is that the just Italian?
Yeah. So as we were doing
version.
Research, even before the hotel named themselves the Martha Washington, we were getting together and doing that, you know, little archiving and historical research, and saw that it used to be the Martha Washington Hotel. So we decided, you know, Martha is a cool two syllable, easy to pronounce, fun name for a restaurant. So we just borrowed Martha in Italian.
So you've got your art history major. I'm thinking there's probably not a lot of boys in art history. In art history departments, so...
No, I was... Yeah, you're right. One of a few boys in my graduate class of art history major.
So, art history becoming very useful in concepting and designing your menu.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, it all started in Rome. It kind of still is happening there. Like, I go to Rome maybe, you know, once a year, sometimes twice, like before we opened up Maialino, and even before we opened up Marta, I took a couple of trips out there specifically to eat around the city. And you're always inspired by it more than just the food when you go to a place like that. It's incredible to see like this amazingly like beautiful, picturesque, like fossilized city that has all these layers of history. And you know, food for me was like, although it came, you know, second, was always to just like being in an amazing place, like walking around and taking it all in.
Mm-hmm.
It was always something that was on the brain, you know, whenever you're walking around there and you're discovering like, you know, these 10 different kinds of carbonara. But, you know, that's also the funny thing about being in Rome, is that every single menu looks exactly the same. Like, so you're like, oh, well, where's the creativity in that? But everybody has their, you know, own proud way of making their carbonara just right. You know,
it's just like the Taiwanese beef noodle soup. and there is no right way, even though American chefs will say, oh, mine is the right, there's one right carbonara. No, you cannot do that.
Yeah.
So then, in a way, when you create your menu, you're doing the same kind of research. And
yeah, we're definitely trying. We're like chef archivists. We really want to, as a team. I mean, it's not just me in a vacuum. It's like me and my sous chefs. We practice these dishes, and we love tradition. We don't necessarily want to just carbon copy, you know, copy and paste exactly what we had.
Color copy of a Van Gogh.
Because you really can't. We don't have the same ingredients. But what we do want to do is make sure that we don't alter, or like if you're going to call something trifa alla romana, or you're going to call something amatriciana, you better damn well know what a real one is like and what it tastes like, and respect the ingredients and the process. And so I would never, you know, put fancy, you know, quirky spins on these dishes. And if I did, I would just call it something else. It's like, don't call it what it's not. So we are very serious about, you know, trying to keep things focused. If we are going to do something that has a Roman name on it, we're going to claim to be a Roman pizzeria, and we're going to put this label on something that it, mm-hmm. that it sings true to the way that the dish is supposed to be.
To the history and culture. So we have like 2 minutes before we have to wind it down. What's your dream job if you were to have one? If you just happen to not go into cooking?
Have to be surfing. I'm a horrible surfer, but I love the water. I love Hawaii. I love, you know, bodyboarding and surfing anytime I can.
Okay, so we're glad that you chose cooking instead. So then. And my very last question for you, you've worked with such greats, Tom Colicchio, Mike Anthony, Valeria Forgione. You worked at Babbo for their openings with Mario Batali and the crew there. Now, I'm curious, like, what's been like your biggest learning from Danny Meyer?
Man, I've learned so much from that man. I mean, he's incredible at what he does. I think that any good thing you've heard somebody say about him is 110% true.
It's okay, but a story to illustrate.
He takes everything super seriously, but he likes to have fun in the process. I think that people don't get to see that enough of him, because he has to be everybody's best friend every time he meets somebody. He's a true hospitalitarian. So, you know, he's constantly, you know, shaking hands and kissing babies, but, you know, you hang out with the guy, and as I did when we went to Rome, he loves food, and he can eat more than anybody I know.
Really? Like, quantity-wise?
Oh, my God, yeah. You think chefs can eat? Like, Danny Meyer can eat. Like, we go out there, and we do, like, 2 lunches, 2 dinners, and we're getting, like, full meals. We're not just like, oh, let's, like, order one thing here and one thing there. We're ordering, like, for 4 people, even if it's just the 2 of us. And it's amazing. I mean, he won't, you know, fill up on bad stuff. I remember him saying, like, you know, don't eat any more of that. It's a waste of stomach space. Like, whenever we had something that was not as good as it could be. But if something is good, I mean, he's finishing the plate. And it was impressive to see. I didn't expect that when we first went on this little Rome research trip.
And a fun fact is, you guys were both in the same art history program in Rome, but just...
That's right, yeah.
Not the same year.
Yeah, it was a Trinity College Rome campus program that we did 20 years apart.
Yeah. Kids, go do that program. You might become great one day. So, with just a little bit of time left to wind it down, Nick wants to tell us that we absolutely need to do champagne at Morta. So what have we got here?
I brought in a 2004 Gaston Chiquet. Mm-hmm. What I love about the champagne list at Marta, I love champagne, first of all, and I think that, you know, the whole highbrow, lowbrow thing, like, having it's a real thing. It's like, champagne is delicious with pizza. It's not just a gimmick. But we have a list there that has, I don't know, like maybe like 12, 14 different bottles under $100, mm-hmm. which are all, I think, awesome.
That's
and to be
amazing.
Able to get like a vintage 2004, which was a great year, champagne, you know, for I think we sell this for like $92.
What a great value! So, yeah. And yes, we should be drinking champagne,
right?
Champagne with your pizza.
Because, are we gonna have some of this?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
And you know, I think that these days, like, restaurants. It's clear that restaurants with wine lists that are thoughtfully, appropriately priced are, it's like where I want to be all the time.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of silly to overprice your wine, I think. And it's, you're not doing yourself any services either. It's like, if you have $100 bottle of wine that, you know, you're having, you know, it's people like want to,
popping the champagne right now. It's
I'm so distracted by this. I don't know.
Do you want me to help you with that? Okay.
Go for it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's, you want people to be drinking good stuff at the table. I mean, like, quite frankly, it's like, as much as I love Prosecco, Lambrusco, and the Italian sparkling, I know it seems crazy, but champagne is... It has a place in Italian restaurants.
This is such a tight cup. It's so slippery. Oh, God. Right,
what's going on over here? Can you figure this out?
This is what happened. So Nick is not a sommelier. Oh, perfect. this is like the first time that we couldn't get a bottle open on the air. This is hilarious. All right, can't wait to taste now that we worked really hard for it.
Earning this one. I have some cold pizza here too.
Oh, really? Awesome. What
talk about bringing sand to the beach.
Yeah.
Here at Roberta's, bringing in a pizza box. This has to be a first, right?
This is the fungi.
Fungi, yeah. So it's got hen of the woods, chanterelles. This is one of my favorite things in the world, mushrooms and champagne.
Thank you. Wow.
Cold pizza.
I'm cold pizza. Okay. Are you chase this with me?
Mm-hmm.
I want your chefy cheers.
Cheers. Not too shabby, right?
Okay, clearly all champagnes and all pizzas go well together. I mean, two of my favorite, edible and quaffable food and drink groups. But why the champagne with this pizza?
Well, it's slightly oxidized, and when you get a little bit of that funk, you go along with fontina cheese and mushrooms I think they play off each other well. And the acidity is there, too, I think mushrooms need acid.
Mm-hmm.
They crave it. And so you've got a little bit of both. You got funk and you got acid going on. It's just delicious wine. Even if you're not eating, I could just crush a bottle of this after service. I often do.
Everybody, try champagne with everything. And thank you so much for the pizza. I actually skipped lunch because my lunch meeting was moved. So very much appreciated, Nick. Thanks so much for joining us.
A lot of fun.
On Word of Mouth. And that was just chef owner Nick Andrew of Mylio with pizza in my mouth. And the brand of the brand new Unisco Hospitality Group Roman Pizzeria Marta in Flatiron. And we also heard from Max Sussman, chef owner of the Cleveland in Soho. As always at the New Market every week, we're live 2 p.m. Eastern, Wednesdays on Word of Mouth,
HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Next week we'll have Chef John Frazier of Dovetail on Narcisa. I'm your host, Lady. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time,
you can
eat
like
well,
us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.